From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the mystery of the Iranian scientist, militancy in the heart of Pakistan, and what's the future for the European Union? An Iranian nuclear scientist who disappeared over a year ago recently turned up at the Pakistani embassy in Washington, D.C. It was the latest twist in the complicated tale of Shahram Amiri. The Iranian government has long claimed that he was kidnapped by the CIA. But U.S. officials dispute that, saying the Iranian scientist was in America of his own free will. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The saga of Shahram Amiri has all the elements of a good intrigue novel. The 32-year-old Iranian nuclear scientist is believed to have vanished while he was making a pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia just over a year ago. Iran complained he was taken by the CIA and possibly Saudi Arabia's intelligence service. The U.S. disputed the claim but wouldn't say anything about Amiri, and there was no word from the scientist himself. That is, until just recently, when a video surfaced. In it, Amiri looks disheveled and speaks nervously in Farsi, his mother tongue, and backs up Iran's claims that he was kidnapped.
For the 8 months that I've been held here, I've come under the worst torture and psychological pressure from America's intelligence agencies. Their goal with the torture and the pressure was to get me to agree to do an interview with an American television network, to say that I'm an Iranian nuclear scientist who sought asylum here and brought important documents and a laptop with proof of Iran's nuclear weapons work.
Karim Sajapour, an Iranian specialist with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says had Amiri been abducted by the CIA, it's unlikely he would have had the freedom to make videos on the internet saying he was abducted by the CIA. Sajapour says more likely he was saying that to help his wife and 7-year-old son back in Iran.
His wife and child were not allowed to leave Iran to join him in the United States, and they were apparently under tremendous pressure by the Iranian government.
Months after Amiri's disappearance, the Iranian government revealed it was building a second uranium processing plant near the holy city of Qom, prompting speculation that Amiri may have leaked that information to the U.S. Shortly after the first video of Amiri appeared, another one was released on the internet. This one looked professionally produced with good lighting. Amiri is smartly dressed and appears to be reading from a script. He says he's attending a university in Arizona.
My agenda while I'm here in America is to simply work on my PhD in health physics. After I'm finished, as long as I'm able to travel safely, I'm hoping that my studies here will help Iranians and the international scientific and university communities.
Amiri said he's safe and he's free to move around the country. The Carnegie Sajapour says that's not unusual. He says Iran's nuclear program is highly compartmentalized. Amiri is a young junior scientist who probably doesn't have access to top state secrets about the program. Sajapour says Amiri isn't as big a fish as other Iranian officials who have defected to the U.S. over the years.
The case of a senior Revolutionary Guards liaison with Hezbollah who defected in 2006 and hasn't been heard from since. I imagine he's under very tight surveillance. But I think someone like Shahram Amiri, after they're initially debriefed by U.S. officials, then eventually they're allowed to live their lives. They're not going to be under surveillance for the next several decades.
Even so, Sajapour says Amiri appears to have made the decision to return home to Iran. The nuclear scientist made his way to Washington and on Monday showed up at the Pakistani embassy, which represents Iranian interests, saying he wants to go home. U.S. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley says the U.S. will not stop him.
The United States government has maintained contact with him. I can't tell you specifically when he made this decision to return to Iran, but he's here of his free will, and this is his decision to depart, and we are helping to facilitate that departure.
Crowley says Amiri will leave the U.S. once his travel plans are settled. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
In Pakistan, far from the mountainous tribal belt where the Taliban first appeared, an extremist network has taken root in the country's heartland. Punjab province is home to more than half of Pakistan's 175 million people, but it's also the base of an increasingly dangerous web of Punjabi militants, and they've teamed up with the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda. NPR's Julie McCarthy travelled to Punjab and sent this report.
Here in Multan, known as the City of Sufis and Saints, this treeless, unpaved lane is testament to the long legacy of militants in the Punjab. We're standing on so-called Martyr Street, in a row of rubble-strewn streets, housing families who lost sons and fathers. They fought in the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan and later against the Indians in Kashmir. And they joined up when the government was promoting jihad as a state policy in the 1980s and 90s. Today, a new generation in southern Punjab is being raised on a brand of Islam that has declared war against the government and the people of Pakistan.
South Punjab has always been very different from the rest of Punjab.
Khalid Ahmed is one of the foremost experts on Pakistan's militant groups. He says extremists have gained a foothold in southern Punjab because governance is weak and feudal landowners dominate.
There you have to work in tandem with the big person there. And that big person is being replaced by the clergy. The clergy which has weaponized. So that's why South Punjab is such a breeding ground.
Punjab is home to nearly half of Pakistan's 20,000 madrasas. Hundreds of religious seminaries in Multan follow the hardline Deobandi school of Islam, not unlike the puritanical Wahhabism practiced by Al-Qaeda's founders. A recent Friday sermon at this mosque gave prominent mention to the July 1st bombing in the provincial capital, Lahore, at the country's most important Sufi shrine. While authorities suspect Islamist extremists, the cleric was quick to blame the Americans. Maulana Muhammad Kafil Bukhari said the suicide attack that left dozens dead was the work of the security firm Blackwater. It's so easy to blame the Taliban in southern Punjab, Bukhari said, but I say it's been carried out by the enemies of this country, the foreign intelligence services, to create anarchy and to break Pakistan up, he says. Punjab's governor calls the notion that Blackwater was involved rubbish. But Bukhari's sermon falls on receptive young ears. 23-year-old Ali Mardan believes the U.S. is supporting local terrorists to destabilize Pakistan and seize its nuclear weapons.
They are afraid that if any religious man become a prime minister or a president or he take over the government, he will create a lot of problem for U.S.
17-year-old Mohammed Noman says an Islamic state like Pakistan has a duty to prepare for jihad to defend the faith. An aspiring cleric, Noman says militant groups, although banned, must continue to train.
We consider this training and this preparation for jihad is something good, and it is for our own protection. It is not for terrorism.
Senior Punjab police investigator Usman Anwar says there are as many as 30 armed outfits in the country's richest, most populous province. Most are splinter groups from organizations that are now outlawed. Sepah-e-Sahaba, Lashkar-e-Janwi, and Jaish-e-Muhammad, the alleged recruiter of Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad. The 2001 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan gave these groups renewed fervor.
Al-Qaeda told them that, you know, the jihadis, they have beaten Russia. Now it is time for the West to have a taste of its own medicine. Now they had a greater cause.
Anwar says they attack Pakistani targets because they regard their government as a tool of the U.S. He says his many interrogations of young militants start out as debates about perceived international injustices and move to local inequities. And there are many in a place like the southern Punjab, says local analyst Haider Gardezi.
Militancy grows in those pockets where there's deprivations, where there is injustice, where there is lack of education. So it's basically a question of backwardness.
Aisha Siddiqa, visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University, says it's not just madrasas in poor places providing recruits. Young, tech-savvy engineers from government-run schools are quietly being pulled into the militant network.
They are coexisting with other social forces as well. And that is the trick. you don't attract attention, so everybody can say, oh, no, 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 there is no, but there is no Talibanization.
Parliamentarian Waqas Akram says in his district, so strong is the band Sepa-e Sahaba that it flaunts its identity with flags and gun-toting bodyguards. Akram says you wouldn't know that the group's leader is on a government watch list.
That man is moving freely, attending funerals, going to madrasas, going to the deputy commissioner office, going to the police chief office. What is this?
Author Khalid Ahmed says these groups are banned in name only and thrive because it suits the ruling party of the province, the Pakistan Muslim League, led by the country's main opposition figure, Nawaz Sharif. His brother is the chief minister of Punjab. Khalid Ahmed says the Sharifs are pulled in two directions.
They are very much joined at the hips with the clergy in Lahore, and they have grown up like that. But they have also grown up relating to outside powers like the United States, that secular societies are probably more tolerant because they are not fanatics. So there is this confusion, ideological confusion in the family.
In the aftermath of the attack on Lahore's Sufi shrine, mainstream clerics accused the Punjab government of being soft on extremist groups. Since the bombing in Lahore, protesters have taken to the streets of the Punjabi capital decrying terrorism. The two men most responsible for administering the province, the governor and the chief minister Shahbaz Sharif, have been at odds over how to treat the growing menace. A spokesman for Sharif insists that he's taking a tough stance. But in March, the chief minister pleaded with the militants to spare Punjab because his party shares their anti-Western attitude. Punjab government Salman Taseer, who is from the ruling People's Party, called that craven.
If you don't take a tough stance against these people right now and nip it in the bud, they'll start spreading like a cancer virus.
A cache of illegal arms, including 500,000 rounds of bullets, was recently uncovered outside Lahore. Detained suspects told investigators of plans to attack 18 new sites. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Lahore.
Coming up, after the euro crisis, what does the future hold for the European Union?
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The European Union is made up of 27 countries and more than 500 million people. To strengthen that union and deepen the financial links between the member states, 16 of the countries have given up their own currencies, and they've joined the euro. However, this year's crisis over the sovereign debt of some members, particularly Greece, has thrown the future of the euro, and even the EU itself, into doubt. We've been running a series of stories about the future of Europe, and in this piece, NPR's Rob Gifford asks, can the European experiment survive?
If you want to understand the biggest problem faced by the euro currency, don't look at fiscal policy or monetary policy, look at soccer. Fans crowded into one of central Amsterdam's large public squares exploded with joy last week as another Dutch goal was scored in this year's World Cup. But how the Dutch fans watching the games here see themselves and their identity says much about why the euro currency and the European Union, of which it's a crucial part, are in trouble.
We're Dutch. Yeah, we're Dutch first, yes.
Dutch, yes, first.
Dutch. Dutch first, definitely.
Although there are euro coins in their pockets, there is no European soccer team on their screens. It turns out that it takes more than a few EU treaties and a new currency to overcome centuries of fierce nationalism for people like 25-year-old student Daniel Dunker and his friends.
They want to make one European front against the Americans. With money, that's not a problem, but if it changes the culture and anything, then it's going to be a problem.
As the euro crisis unfolded earlier this year, the glaring contradiction at the heart of the single currency was exposed. People and governments were happy to go as far as to adopt the euro, but they didn't want to take it further, give up their national identity and join into some kind of political United States of Europe. Soccer fan Daniel Dunker highlights the second problem.
Our tax money
is going into Europe instead of our own country, to Greece and to other and Portugal and those kind of countries. We pay for their mistakes.
In a fully federal system like the United States, you can vote for different people with different policies on taxation and redistribution of federal tax money. In the European Union, you can't. Dutch or German voters can't vote for Greek politicians who set Greek economic policy, even though, as they've found out recently, Greek economic policy affects them greatly. Since the crisis and the threat of the euro's collapse, some EU bureaucrats say the only answer is to go for greater EU integration, including control from Brussels of each member state's taxation and spending. The Brussels correspondent of The Economist magazine is David Rennie.
The problem is that's just not going to happen. You look at public opinion, there just isn't support for that kind of great leap forward. So if their stark choice is disintegration versus integration, well, they better have a plan B. And it's going to have to involve ad hoc solutions and fudge and mudge and muddling through.
As well as working out how to say fudge and mudge in 27 European languages, the EU has been trying informal attempts to harmonise those national policies on taxing and spending. But David Rennie says that has exposed very different opinions between the Euro's two key members, France and Germany.
If you're speaking to someone who is either German or in the sort of Germanic camp, they'll say, oh, it's very simple. We need to have Germanic-style rigour and discipline, and people need to live within their means and not borrow and spend too much. Then you sit down someone from the southern European bloc led by France. They go, well, it's very simple. We have to have redistribution from richer countries to poor. We have to lower the borrowing costs for governments who are currently being fleeced by these evil, wicked Anglo-Saxon speculators.
And these disagreements have slowed the European response to the crisis. But what of the countries that are seen as the problem, known by their unfortunate acronym, the PIGS? Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. In a small restaurant on a cobbled street in the shadow of Lisbon's Sé Cathedral, a performer is singing Fado, the traditional Portuguese lament. Though not as profligate as Greece, Portugal still has plenty to lament. Lax collection of taxes and a bloated public sector for a start. Sitting listening to the music is Miguel Judiche, the president of the Portuguese Hotel Association. He loves the euro. It brings so many benefits, he says. But he says things in Portugal do need to change.
If you're living in a civilized country, you need to pay taxes, as it happens in Sweden more than in Portugal. Which doesn't mean that we want to be culturally identical to the Swedish. I think it's important to bridge the gap socially and economically, but not culturally, I think.
Observers have been encouraged. There have been almost no protests so far at the austerity measures proposed in Portugal, and that the PIGS seem to be prepared to take their medicine.
Either we change or we'll be left behind.
Portuguese economist Camilo Lourenço says the alternative, leaving the euro with its low interest rates and low inflation, is too dire to contemplate. He, for one, thinks greater EU integration is imperative.
I do think it would be very important to create a European Union treasury, a ministry of finance in Brussels. A single currency will not survive if you have 16 or 17 different countries spending as they please.
Beethoven's Ode to Joy is still the official anthem of the European Union, but it's clear that national capitals are not singing from the same hymn sheet. For some, the establishment of a fund of nearly $1 trillion in May to prevent the euro collapsing shows there is support for a United States of Europe. André Sapir is a senior fellow at Bruegel, an economics think tank in Brussels.
Even if you don't add those words under the check of $1 trillion, to me, it sounds very much like a step towards fiscal union. And what else is fiscal union if not the beginning of a political union?
Others say that it may in fact be the wealthy countries like Germany who decide they don't want to pick up the tab any longer.
We are on a knife edge, without a doubt.
David Marsh is a Financial Times reporter turned banker who has written a book about the euro.
Although both routes would be very, very difficult and very calamitous for the European ideal, I think on balance it's more likely that the stronger currencies would leave over the next, say, 3 to 5 years than the weaker ones. it would still be an immense parting of the ways for Europe, and it would be a demolition of the European ideal.
Eastern European and Baltic and Balkan nations are still lining up to join the euro, but the currency and the whole extraordinary European experiment are under grave threat. They're stuck, unable to go backwards because the countries are integrated too far, but also unable to go forwards because of those same deep-rooted national histories that the EU and the euro were set up to overcome. Rob Gifford, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.